Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
You're listening to Double Feature. My name is Eric 13, and I am here with Double Feature Year 10 expert, Michael Kester.
Ooh, I'm the expert 2 weeks in a row. Look out, guys.
You're the expert 500 weeks in a row. 521 weeks in a row, you've been the expert.
22?
Whether it's the expert on, is it? I don't know. I think you're not the expert on numbering the shows, but you are the expert on a variety of topics from Michael Kester's refrigerator to Double Feature Year 10.
Cool.
This is Year 10, right?
Yeah. Oh, I guess God. Since I live by myself, I would be the definitive expert on my refrigerator. But there was probably a time in my life where I wasn't even that. That's sad to think about.
I was referring to that first episode. I was hoping
I know.
There were two other people who lived in that place. I don't know if either of them
was
were.
Was it two or was it six? I have a hard time.
Might have been. You've had some very commune. You're often like a cult leader, creator of a commune.
That's fair.
Hey, speaking of a cult leader, ooh, Michael Kester.
Yeah, what's up?
Yeah, I don't know.
Cool.
Let's billboard the show today because usually we're talking two films and today we're talking more than 100 films.
Somewhere between 0 and 1,100, right?
Yeah, that's
right. Did you see that I check movie shit?
No, I didn't.
You didn't see that?
I told you, man, I'm on the letterbox.
No,
we got a schism here.
No. Letterbox is all well and good, but what didn't happen on Letterbox is we didn't have somebody go through our entire back catalog and create an I Check Movies list on Letterboxd.
I did see that. I thank you for that.
Fucking amazing.
We have the greatest listeners.
I'm going to give a shout out. Just give me a moment to shout that out. I got to pull up my phone. This is live, motherfucker.
Okay. I was vamping for you while you recalled who the fuck did that.
Ooh, Damon Albarn tweeted for the first time in a while.
That was not who did that.
I'm getting it. I just got to scroll.
Okay. Well, here's what we're going to do on this show, and then we'll come back around to this at a very timely place. It'll probably just be whenever I take a breath. No, still not yet. Okay, that's good. What we're doing on the show today is we've spent an entire year talking about all these pairs of movies, and the whole year is done. We did it all as a year of programming, what we called year 10. We did a hard restart. We did all these films together, and now it's done. We're going to look back on that year. So if you skipped out on some of the pairs, maybe you skipped all the pairs, maybe this is the first fucking time you've ever heard Double Feature, this is a great episode because it's going to kind of give you the summation of really what happened. Mostly the best instances of both pairs and movies, but we'll also talk about some of the odd one-off little trails we went down, some adventures, mountains we have climbed, killapaloozas we have paloozed.
Sure.
Killapaloozas we got our wristband for, or whatever the appropriate Lollapalooza sort of tie-in for that would be.
Mm-hmm.
I think we only had a couple of those this year. Let's start talking about this stuff right now, actually.
Well, actually, before we talk about that, it was Bruno Hunziker.
I knew that.
The fellow who created the... Yeah, so real quick though, while I'm like literally on the air, 4 hours ago... And you helped me out with this. 4 hours ago, he tweeted Canadian standoff, and now there's I have choices here of Denis Villeneuve or David Cronenberg. What should I choose live on Double Feature?
Oh my God! I think people are gonna have to write in because it's live, and that's how nothing
works.
Wow!
I voted, and there have been two votes, and it is 100% the answer I voted for.
Oh, this is exciting. Everyone, not go on that Twitter because I was trying to do a thing. I'm trying to queue up a fucking thing.
Yeah.
First of all, how many, what did we,
mm-hmm.
how many and what did we?
Sure.
We did two killapaloozas.
Two killapaloozas. Yeah, we kept it light because we're running out of kills to palooza.
Although they're coming back. I don't want to give away the next year, but I thought there's a couple I've stumbled onto where I'm like, hey, I should check this out. Ugh, there's 10 of them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's usually good killapalooza territory.
Mm-hmm.
But we talked about Resident Evil. and we talked Return of the Living Dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like every year we're going to end up scraping the bottom of the barrel. And those were two franchises that are huge and needed to be talked about.
I mean, one literally does scrape the bottom of the barrel by the nature of the canon of the film. Actually, both do. But
sure, sure.
But
well, with Resident Evil, I was pretty excited to, I hope we've billboarded everything at the top because I'm done billboarding. I don't care about billboarding anymore. Is there anything we didn't cover? We're going to talk about all the movies today.
Yeah, we're going to talk
we're
about
the movies.
We're
going to count stuff down, maybe-ish.
The other thing too that I think is important, the last billboard, and I know you hate when I do this, but we're also going to talk about the world that existed in year 10 of Double Feature because I think that's one of the more interesting things we can do.
Yeah, I just don't like living in that world. That's
yeah,
all.
It's
That's
just
all
like,
I don't
it,
like about
I think,
it.
I think what's super important as we get to the end of these years and we kind of slough off the desire to thumbs up, thumbs down shit, it's super important for us to kind of time capsule these 52 shows. Just because, I mean, if only because our opinions have just changed so dramatically. We were just talking on the last episode about just the movie Fargo and how it went from being a non-film to something that we both laud as possibly
yeah.
one of the greater films ever made. And it's just, I wish that Double Feature Michael and Eric year two could have at the end of the show been like, we're dumb and young and this is all subject to change.
Yeah.
But instead we're cleaning up after those bastards, even 10 years later.
No, it is good to stop down and consider the time. Do you get the general sense, and then we'll get back to this Killapalooza thing. Do you get the general sense we're getting smarter?
I feel like we're definitely learning a lot. I think one of the things that this year has taught me is really how to, we talked about it a little bit with Shawshank Redemption. I think what's really kind of a thing that I can really latch onto is that you and I have, it feels like we've really mastered the ability to take the themes and really have the powerful conversations that we've always wished we could have.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, like honestly, like I'm looking at, I've got the whole thing pulled up right here, but like, you know, it's not an intrinsic strong conversation to be had about Industrial Symphony number one. That conversation is not there to be had. And I think that somebody who hadn't done 10 years of watching films, learning from films, and you know, bouncing it off this same other personality for 10 years, I don't think we could have hit some of the things that we hit.
Yeah.
But definitely, and in full conceit, I feel much smarter.
You know, part of the wonder of only seeing a couple things rubs off. And I do miss a little bit of that. When there were only five films in the world, it was really easy to know what I liked and what I didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
But on the whole, I do feel like every year, here's the way I'll put this. Every year I pinpoint what year Double Feature got good, mm-hmm. got like competent mm-hmm. enough to really be worth listening to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're about to say something real upsetting.
And every year that moves back further.
Yeah.
Is that,
yeah.
That's where you,
yeah, I mean,
you feared
that,
I was going.
I think that's the nature. I mean, that's good though, right? Is if we weren't improving this show, we probably wouldn't be planning the pair that we're planning next week.
That is true. I wanted to follow up on, I swear we're getting back to Killapalooza, but I want to follow up on Industrial Symphony. This is one of the other things I love doing during the year end. When we go out and do the show, we just have 24 minutes to have some kind of conversation. We've usually just seen the films. We have questions. And then a regrettable thing happens and we accidentally learn more information when we've already recorded a show and knowledge is completely useless.
Well, because what happens is people go, what movies did you review? Is the question that they ask. Right? And uh-huh. and then you go,
none.
Well, none, but
no reviews.
We did talk about Industrial Symphony number one and Lucifer Rising. And then they look at you like a dog that you've just fake thrown a ball toward and they go, I haven't seen those. And then I say in response, of course you haven't seen them. I don't expect that you've seen them, but check them out. They're on YouTube or some shit. But I'm guessing you had this conversation. What movies did you review? And you said, I didn't review any movies. Then they said, well, what movies did you cover, asshole? And then you said Industrial Symphony number one. And somebody you brought it up to went, oh, you know, actually something about that. And here we are.
No, I don't know any people.
Sure.
I don't know people.
So you set it to the internet in a in a search engine.
No, actually, I read it in a book.
Like a book?
Isn't that crazy? Not even just a book, but like a physical one that wow. I held in my hands and turned pages as I read it.
Were you in a lobby?
I was in a library.
Oh my God.
That, no joke.
Surrounded
crazy,
by other physical books.
I know. Year two, Eric would not recognize year 10, Eric. I could fucking tell you that for sure. Yeah. So we had had some questions about Industrial Symphony number one for David Lynch, who is already a what the fuck, how is this thing come into being film creator. Created this movie that felt like, even for David Lynch, how did this movie come into? If somebody else had made Industrial Symphony number one, it might make more sense than David Lynch. And I found out a lot of that was just looking at it and seeing where is this giant stage and these things he has on it. And it's just such a weird, whatever, go back, listen to the show. But I discovered that was done at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and it was all filmed, I don't know if this makes it more or less crazy, over one day. He had one day filmed the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
Utterly insane. It was just a lot of prep.
That improves the pair.
It does. It does. Yeah. It really does. Yeah. But just rehearsed the fuck out of it and shot it. And he talks, you know what? This is not the Industrial Symphony show. So I just, I updated you with some information. Let's get back
set
to the
Killapaloozas. Set the hook.
Yeah, that's it. Let's just have some discipline. So the thing I was going to say about Killapaloozas this year is Resident Evil, we got to talk about how it doesn't get the appreciation in the horror community that a juggernaut series of financially successful multi-million dollar films, six in running, basically all created by the same dude, starring the same people, should probably get.
Mm-hmm.
It's so nuts to me that just something about Resident Evil doesn't get applauded the way. There is sort of a discrimination in the horror community against modern films.
Sure.
I mean, if these were films of this exact same quality, but from the late 80s,
sure,
people would just be talking about it nonstop.
I'd like to qualify that further and modern films with a budget of that size. Horror movies with big budgets need to have come out in the 80s or before for the general horror audience. Because now we're in a world of post-Get Out world, which I told you was fucking coming, by the way. Did I not fucking tell you we were headed for a post-Get Out world? And now here we are with the fucking Quiet Place, with fucking Hereditary, with fucking Upgrade. I mean, we are in a post-Get Out horror world. And I fucking called it. Go back to that show and listen to me call it. And also listen to me call how good Colossal is on that show.
It's coming. Believe me, it's coming. When we count down the best films of the year, the greatest films that came out in this year or other years, but happen to have been seen on this show. Return of the Living Dead, we had talked a little bit about those last two films and how there's a weird thing happening where these franchises just like go to Romania.
Mm-hmm.
And I also found out a little something about that,
mm-hmm.
which is that...
First, I want to know where it came from.
If I told you I read it in a book, it would seem like I'm trying to tell you I read books all the time.
Where'd you read it? Did you read it in a book?
No, stop. I refuse to tell you
what... Were you in a lobby?
What or if I read it in a book? I refuse to tell you. Oh, man. What happens is these studios wait until they've bought a bunch of properties or acquired the rights to specific franchisable properties. This is going to click a huge fucking light bulb for Killapaloozas people, hopefully including yourself. But you wait until you got like, maybe you acquired the rights to, I don't want to call out the company because that might further go down the road of how I acquired this information. But let's just say, I don't know, like a Children of the Corn and a Hellraiser and a Howling and a Return of the Living Dead. They get all these properties. And once they've got a string of like nine of them, then they get a special package deal in Romania to shoot them all. So they just green light like nobody's fucking business, nine different franchises at once, and they all get shot in Romania. And that's why all of these Killapaloozas seem to have some weird Romanian installment that's just done by some person. Maybe you've never heard of them, or they do two back to back. We talked a lot about on Return of the Living Dead about the strange phenomenon, where the fuck does it come from? And of course, something about money and studios. Mm-hmm. That's the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And tax write-offs. So there you have it.
Yep.
So that's all the Killapaloozas. That was the whole thing for the year.
Yeah, watch more fucking film.
No, okay. There's more. Watch more fucking film. No, I refuse. I don't know if you wanted to. I know every year we treat this a little bit different. I also want to indulge that conversation about the zeitgeist a little bit. And I know we have some pairs that are worth revisiting, some of the pairs that went most successfully. And then I got a whole list of like 10 movies to be like, yo, good movie.
Sure.
Where do you want to start on all of the other things for today?
I mean,
you were talking about this post Get Out world a little bit.
Yeah.
Do you want to?
I mean, I think that's a huge thing. I think it's going to inform.
If I tug on that string, does that?
I think it's going to inform a lot of conversations going forward in the next year of Double Feature. Because, so Get Out came out. It's a movie we covered a while back this year on Double Feature. And it's amazing. I mean, it's just fucking so good. I've seen it 3 times since I saw it in the theater. And it's just, it gets better every time. It's a movie that good. But it did this thing, it created this market. Did I equate this to grunge rock on the show? Or was that just a personal thing?
No, I don't think so. But we have had the quote unquote Get Out conversation at least 4 times.
Yeah. So, so in a nutshell, it's similar to the 90s music scene when grunge was happening. And so I hesitate to say that Get Out is the Nirvana of this scene. And I would instead say that Get Out is kind of the advent, which would be, you know, one of the lesser known bands that was gaining acclaim that influenced Nirvana, or in this case, The Quiet Place, to come out and just be like widely adored as this underground sensation. Get Out got an Academy Award nomination. It's the Sonic Youth. You can't argue that nobody knew about it. But The Quiet Place came out and everybody you fucking know went, did you hear about this movie called The Quiet Place? As if not everybody had heard that Jim from The Office made a horror movie produced by one of the wealthiest film studios in the current film market. And everybody all kind of went, yeah, I'm really into this indie horror. You know, it's this, people don't really know much about it. And since then, man, we're in this universe where, and I mean this in a good way, but let me kind of explain this and extend my metaphor. We're in the world now where Quiet Place comes out and that's Nevermind, and Hereditary has come out and that's, you know, Pearl Jam's 10. And we're going to have these horror movies. They're going to keep dropping, and they're just going to be these quintessential new wave of the horror movement. They're going to become these pillars for when horror finally came back and people reaccepted it as a genre, but a genre that connects, you know, and reason being maybe, you know, because we live in a terrifying new world. But what's invariably going to happen, man, and when this happens with art, is you have Platinum Dunes come out and produce Nevermind or The Quiet Place. And then they go, now we're only going to produce small budget horror movies. That's all we're going to do. We're done with this sequel shit. And eventually, man, it's Smash Mouth, you know? Eventually,
sure,
somebody's coming out with a version of something that's a version of something that's a regurgitated version of a thing. And then somebody once told me the world was going to roll me. I ain't the sharpest tool in the shed. And you just want to kill yourself. And that's when you get, and I think about this, in hindsight, it's so clear to me, and maybe I'm wrong, but in hindsight, it's so clear to me, the last time that horror had this resurgence was the 80s. And you and I fucking, we let 80s horror movies come wherever they want. And then the Smash Mouth was the 90s. The Smash Mouth was The Dentist, or Prince of Darkness, or Attic Expeditions, which is even later, but like it's that same tone of like, this is some...
Also a movie only you and I and Jeremy Kasdan know exists.
This is some garbage version of a slightly less garbage version of a misappropriated version of a great horror movie.
Uh-huh.
And not to undercut the glory of a movie like Hereditary, but I just want people to be strapped in for the fact that horror can be this good even when the Smash Mouth starts coming out.
The thing that if we really want to go down a dark and scary road, I want you to imagine what the brainless studio version of bleak, oppressive horror is. It sounds like the worst time ever.
Exactly.
That's not something that's going to adapt well into, oh, this wasn't really, it's all the work with none of the artistic merit.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll happen eventually. And I don't think people will react well. And it might be enough where the first misstep shuts down the whole thing.
I mean, yeah.
But it's an exciting time nonetheless.
Yeah, and I don't wanna undercut that. I just want people to keep their eye on the horizon. That it's important to go see, you know, The Quiet Place and Hereditary. It's important to see these movies in the theater and really vote with those dollars, because there's going to come a point where people are going to vote for the dollars for you, and then you have to tell them no. And I think just because of the bitter irony of cinema, I feel like it's going to come from the same fucking place that one of these two did. You know, I feel like Blumhouse is going to drop the ball, or Platinum Dunes is going to drop the ball, and they're going to ruin it for everyone.
Only the most cynical takes on Double Feature. The poor horror community is like reached a pinnacle of artistic integrity, and we're just here like, yeah, but somebody's going to fuck up. Just wait. Somebody's going to fuck it up. What do you think in regards to the things that happened on the show this year where our pairs kind of related to that? Because I feel like if we talk about a movie being maybe oppressive, you know, Get Out feeds into that, and we did that on the show this year. But I see certain places where we did something like, let's say like The Witch. The Witch has some oppression vibes to it. It's got a little bit of that bleak tone going on.
I mean, Bad Batch and Raw.
But, you know, we paired those movies. I think The Bad Batch might be the best example of tone this year for, you know, having a little bit of a bleak world, but also having some strange kick of like inherent fun that you can't shake off. In The Bad Batch, I think that's just the comedic sort of dressings of the whole, just the winking, smiling face of the whole thing. But we did The Witch with The Autopsy of Jane Doe. And for some reason, I think about those movies, and since the time that those have happened on the show, that was the first pair of the year, it was it kind of answered the question of why horror in spectacular fashion. I think that was the idea of what can you accomplish with the genre? Why are these things happening? You know, really, really opening that up. I know that The Witch was pretty bleak, but in my head now, it's just kind of like Black Phillip memes and fun. There's like a fun, funny, you know what I mean? Like, I think about The Witch and I go, oh, that's happy. I'm happy The Witch exists. What a fun. And, you know, The Autopsy of Jane Doe, I'm just like, what a blast. What a great time watching that movie.
I mean, I think the two of those movies have a different, they live in a different place for me. And this is something I've learned actually from this year. Life snapshot. I just said Snapchat. Life snapshot for Michael here. For over half of the production of Double Feature, I was in a relationship with a single person. The person wasn't single. It was one person. They weren't single because they were in a relationship with me.
Right. I think we follow that.
Cool. Just making sure. And
explains why the show's so creepy though.
Right. So for the majority,
the entire time I was in the relationship with a single person.
Yeah, exactly. And so for the majority of this year of Double Feature, that ended. And that was kind of devastating for me on a personal level, but you know, fuck that. This is a movie podcast. But what it lended itself to, and it's something that's really interesting and something that has really made me reassess a lot of Double Feature, is I'm watching a lot of these movies again. The Witch and Autopsy of Jane Doe are prime examples. Bad Batch is another good example. I'm watching these movies with people that don't know me, that I haven't been with for 5 years. I'm watching The Witch with somebody who, you know, they come over to my house for the first time and I go, oh, The Witch is awesome. Let's watch it. Blindly going, I love The Witch. It's an awesome movie. And it's the first time you get to see The Witch, or let me put it a different way. It's like you get to see The Witch for the first time a second time.
Yeah.
It reconnects you to that initial tone. Because like you're saying, I watch The Witch and I go, this is just amazing. It's funny. The goat, the way it looks, it's so bleak. How hilarious.
Yeah, I know. Watching movies has become too enjoyable for us.
But just you like watch it with
meta-human.
Yeah, you watch it with somebody who's seen The Witch for the first time, man, and you get to watch yourself see it for the first time and remember, oh no, this isn't fun at all. It's not a good time.
Yeah.
But Autopsy of Jane Doe, to flip the board on that, I mean, you watch Autopsy of Jane Doe with someone for the first time and you go, this is such a good movie. We're having so much fun. Or you watch somebody squirm at the in Don't Breathe and you're like, yeah, this is such a fucking fun, good movie. But then, you know, and then you have The Witch or some of these other movies that we cover that are just, I mean, this is something I've noticed that I really like in a movie, but it's hard for me is Brawl and Cell Block 99 is another one.
Mm-hmm.
Movies that are great and I like to watch them, but they're not a good time.
I've started revisiting a lot of those. I had to force myself to do that.
I use the phrase walking out of the theater for something that we haven't done on the show, like Annihilation.
Mm-hmm.
And I use the phrase, well, that was no fun at all. And that doesn't mean it's a bad movie. That means that the movie is kind of this bleak, relentless barrage that has forfeit the preconceived notion that people need a break from feelings.
Yeah.
That people need, you know, a comic relief. Sure, comic relief works. I love the Lego movie too, man. But like, there is something really strong about this new wave of horror that goes, it's not funny. It's just not funny. It's not fun.
Sure.
And I think that's one of the cogs in the horror machine that has made horror way more easy for mass appeal is because the schlock came from the dopey stoner friend or the schlock came from those two slutty cheerleaders. How funny it was when Jason smashed that guy's face on a tree. You strip that away and you go, this is just a movie that's horrific.
I think part of this, to talk about the broader world again, has been the movies that are in theaters, that make it to a theater. The one common trait amongst all of them is that they are viciously scary.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that could mean any number of things about the tone of the movie. Ghost Stories is a much different movie than the fourth Insidious, is much different than Hereditary.
Mm-hmm.
They're different in artistic grounds and plot grounds in who you would think would see them. But without fail, I mean, I go see every time a horror movie's in a theater, I see it. I'll see all of them. And really pretty much without exception, they are movies that are scary. And they try very hard. You can tell very deliberately that was part of the plan. Is people need to ride the roller coaster while they're doing this. All the way from talking about It, you know, we talked about this.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple exceptions. I actually think Get Out might be an exception to that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and they're sort of sprinkled here and there, but man, few and far between. And so we know that, and this is also why I think in a time of the smallest amount of religion our country has ever seen, people are showing up left and right to ghost movies.
Mm-hmm.
Not because ghosts themselves are suddenly scary to people, but what says if the market has figured out that people want to go see movies to scare themselves, what says this is a scary movie more than what's the movie about? Thing goes boo.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fucking ghost. You know,
sure.
Ghost movie just says, you don't need to know anything about what's going to happen in this movie. All you need to know is it's definitely going to be scary.
Yeah, you go, it's called Boo, a Madea Halloween 2.
Yeah. If it's not scary, what could it even be? It has to be scary. Ghosts go boo.
Right.
And you immediately conjure up that image of a thing popping out and you're going, ah.
Sure.
And so there is something to be said about what audiences are looking for right now, that they're looking for that experience of frightening themselves. I don't think that necessarily means, I don't think people went and saw a movie like Hereditary because they went, ah, yes, the oppressive art house, I need this. Mm-hmm. They went, that looks scary as fuck.
Yeah. And then they go, I heard that was scary as fuck. And then another person goes,
right.
It is as scary as you've heard it is. And then that draft house, did you see the heart rate thing?
Yes. Yeah.
And then that shit comes out and then it's like, oh my God, it is clinically scary as fuck.
The thing that's happening with a lot of these movies artistically is on a total side wave with the fact that they're scary. You know, you when we talk about a movie on Double Feature, we're typically talking about the talkiest components of the movie, themes or what it's doing. We're not usually talking about, holy fuck, this was scary. But those are the very things that I think are getting people to see the movies. Mm-hmm. I think the movies are popular because they fit in that area for horror, speaking just obviously specifically about horror. But we did get the opportunity to cover a lot of stuff this year that also fit in horror, wasn't scary, but was just as intellectual a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
When we had the Tragedy Girls and Ingrid Goes West show, one of my favorite shows of the year.
God, such a good show.
Those were movies that had festival releases, but they did not get the theatrical release of any of the movies that we've talked about up to this point in horror. And I'm glad that there's still a market for those things. I'm glad people are seeing them on VOD. But those are the ones that I'm really the happiest about championing this year. A movie like Colossal that we did with Get Out. You know, people were able to see Get Out in the theater. That was, in my mind, the best kind of release and experience a movie doing a lot of these talky things could really, you know, these kind of heady concepts could expect.
Yeah.
Colossal did not get the treatment of Get Out. I think even today, Colossal is still one of the more under the radar
mm-hmm.
big movie. It has stars in it. Mm-hmm. It's a big movie. Mm-hmm. It's accessible. It's not scary. It's a kaiju movie.
Yeah.
You know, the themes are what's scary.
Yeah.
What else did you think about Pears that you liked this year?
I mean, there's a few that I'm like really kind of proud of.
I know this is a weird question for you because you came up with almost all the Pears this year.
Yeah.
So it's a very self-congratulatory thing to ask you to be right? like, and which ones were the best, bit. Michael? But here, let me give you a couple more so you don't have to think about them. I also really loved, I usually call out on the show when I fucking love the pair, but
yeah.
I think an early one we didn't talk a lot about later was Barbershop and Wall Street.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of a differing economic headaches
yeah.
double feature.
Yeah.
We also talked The Breakfast Club and The Hateful Eight.
God, that was a good show.
Both social interactions trapped in a room, but from specifically the writer-director standpoint,
mm-hmm.
the person who is voicing those very characters is also the one putting them in different spots in the room, really manipulating those pieces. I think if I had to pick one all year, it was Risk and Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah.
That
was a cool show too.
We almost had to laugh about it on that show, how on point it was.
Yeah.
Risk is a documentary. It's about Julian Assange. Ghost in the Shell is, we didn't even do the fucking live adaptation, mm-hmm. the double feature,
right.
embrace the new, whatever weird, not as popular thing adaptation. We literally did the original manga, Ghost in the Shell.
Mm-hmm.
Manga, I know guys, don't send me your Kone Accento.
Yeah.
We did the cartoony one. We did that yeah. cartoony yeah. Ghost in the Shell. No, but I mean, I fucking loved Ghost in the Shell. And that ended up being a show about separating ideas from personhood.
Yeah.
And it was very spot on, but also one of my favorite things Double Feature can do, which is it creates this inherent movie recommendation engine mm-hmm. without just saying, hey, you like this movie, want to see basically a copy of that?
Right.
If you love this movie, you'll love this other thing that did all the stuff you just saw.
Right.
So it's pairing two movies and looking for something thematic or to me, it's a much more, when you present that to me, I get a lot more intellectual stimulation from that going, okay, Risk set up some ideas or even the other direction and that would be cool. Ghost in the Shell sets up these ideas, just ideas, has nothing to do with Julian Assange. Was he even fucking born when that movie came out? Like crazy. And also Ghost in the Shell, no search engine recommendation algorithm would ever give me that movie.
Right.
because I've seen four animes in my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just not going to come up. Yet the things that are being talked about in Risk are very high on my radar. I'm very interested in those things. So to be able to continue that conversation with a fictional work or vice versa is just the great, man, go back in Double Feature and find the movies you like that were paired with something else you've never heard of and watch that fucking movie.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause those are just the ones that make me so happy when I go, oh, I love X, Y, or Z movie. And you go, you know, that would go good with this. I'm probably in for a pretty good time.
Mm-hmm.
A satisfying time in my mind, at least.
There's two pairs that I think I want to call out. And one is one that went exactly the way that I had planned. And so I'm really proud of it.
Uh-huh.
And one is one that I wasn't sure was going to work out. And it totally didn't in the way I thought it would, but was still like an awesome pair. I think the Crank 2 Raid 2 show.
Fuck yeah, I got that one written down too.
That pair was just, I mean, like, we wanted to have a conversation about how you really amp up action when the bar has been set. Those two movies just nail that. Every aspect of that is covered watching those two movies, that one 70-minute movie and that one 3.5-hour movie.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a fucking primer on how to double down with your action shit. And it's fun, but it's the kind of fun you learn from. You see new stuff, you see interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sequels, which is a double bonus because sequels suck, like, categorically. You and I don't agree on this, but you know what I mean, like right. They're both movies where it's like, why would or how would you make a sequel to X,
right?
And then here
coming up on Double Feature, Rings and Adam Wingard's Death Note.
Right. Exactly. Fuck. But the other pair that I put on the show for one reason, and we ended up having a totally different conversation and just really having an awesome show, was Don't Breathe in The Good Neighbor.
Fuck, man. That was my other one.
Yeah. That
I had two that I didn't mention. And those were
movies wise. One of the things that I wanted to mention is that I think the greatest successes this year for film were, so there's this thing that happens. So maybe this is kind of a transition into that conversation, but there's this thing that happens when we're putting together Double Feature, the schedule. And I know you do it and Lord knows I fucking do it, but it's like, this isn't a movie I like, or this isn't a particularly good movie, but mm-hmm. it does have this one aspect I want to have a conversation about, or it does lend itself to a conversation that's actually going to be dominated by this other movie. And that was The Good Neighbor. It was a movie I had seen. I wanted to do Don't Breathe. And I figured that we could basically trample The Good Neighbor with a longer conversation about Don't Breathe and then pretend we switched to talking about James Caan halfway through. What happened was almost the opposite.
Yeah.
And furthermore, I mean, I walked away from that conversation realizing that The Good Neighbor is an incredibly good movie.
Yeah.
And one that really, I mean, it clearly had stuck with me enough for me to think of it when coming up with pair stuff, but it's the uniqueness of its execution and its ability to go, we're doing this thing. We don't need to try other gimmicks, and really just mm-hmm. go full bore on its initial setup. It's just the pair itself brings that movie to so many higher levels than I think it looks like on paper. And I think Don't Breathe is one of those no brainer, like, greatest horror movies to come out in the last 10 years. I think Don't Breathe lives there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that The Good Neighbor bouncing off of Don't Breathe looks, and I know we talk about this all the time, but looks just as fucking good.
Yeah.
It went from a movie that I, quote, had seen to a movie that I will show somebody now.
It's amazing watching movies kind of in isolation or just with the crowd that you see them with and how much that can taint your opinion.
Mm-hmm.
We do this thing on the show where every episode, the two movies are good. Whether they're actually good or not, we're going to treat them like they're good because that's how we get the most unique, the best conversation, and one that is also unique amongst how other people are talking about them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just fucking try that experiment in your own life, see a movie with somebody, before you guys watch the movie, go, let's just entertain that we're not going to evaluate it immediately afterwards, that we're going to try to identify what it's doing or how it's doing it. A lot of times how it's doing it is more interesting
mm-hmm.
and really the artistic heart of the thing. But just fucking make it about themes. Yeah. Just make it about anything. Go after the movie. Agree that after the movie, you're going to sit down and go, what did that movie do that was insightful? What is its reason for existing? What could people learn from it? Any of these questions. Find the redeeming qualities of it. You will be amazed how many times your instant gut check of a movie that's okay becomes, wow, that was actually a really powerful and good movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you would have missed all of that if you didn't indulge its conversation. If you didn't, you know, chew at that stuff a little bit.
Right.
If I learn nothing else from the show, it's really that operating principle that when you start unpacking movies, they all get better.
Mm-hmm.
No movie does not get better from unpacking it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just the fucking facts of life.
That's art, man. That's art in a nutshell. Like, if you ignore a conversation. So here's another movie, favorite movie of the year, man. I mean, not favorite movie of the year. A favorite movie of the year.
Yeah, I was going to say, not how a countdown works, Michael.
But I mean, like, I was fucking hard as shit for this movie when we covered it on the show, and I'm still fucking hard for it, and that's Yoga Hosers.
Oh, yeah.
I fucking love this movie, and if you want to talk about a movie that sucks if you don't want to have a conversation about it, that's the one, man. If you watch Yoga Hosers with a person, and they walk out and go, well, that sucked, and then go to the bathroom, you're like, well, shit. Unless I can break that barrier, they're never going to like this movie. But and it's really similar to the conversation about Human Centipede 3, where I feel like there's just so much intrinsic to the execution of Yoga Hosers that makes it, you have to be so stubborn not to realize that the things you don't like are intentional.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we've used this term a few times on the show this year, but hate fucking your audience is becoming one of my favorite things that you can possibly do as an auteur. And we keep harping on Hereditary because it's like the most current thing. And people could argue maybe Hereditary feels a little bit like hate fucking. It's not, because in my opinion, in order to even have hate fucking license, a license to hate fuck, 0069, is you have to be an auteur of merit and name. You know, Kevin Smith can hate fuck his audience.
Right.
Quentin Tarantino can hate fuck his audience.
Right.
But to go back to this overarching conversation that I've been having internally all year is it lends itself to that confusing element to me of why does it matter to me so much who's making this movie and should it? I'm bringing new people into my film circle. Before, it was you and it was my girlfriend at the time, and it was just people that like got it. They'd seen the shit I'd seen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you and I talk all the time about how it's dangerous to be as tight as we are with films because we've just lost social language outside of your and my dynamic.
Yeah.
And so it's really hard for me because like I go see a movie and I'm telling the person, well, you know, this movie was made by this person which made this. And so when this comes up in the movie, I mean, The Endless is a great example. Nobody's seen Resolution.
Yeah.
And then I'm sitting in the theater coming in my jeans. I mean, and Cult of Chucky is another example of that. Like if somebody walks into Cult of Chucky, I'm like, no, you don't understand. This is Don Mancini 6.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Cult of Chucky, there's a bunch that kind of on my rundown of movies we probably won't get to because there's just Cult of Chucky, Bug, Chinatown, fucking Prevenge, Blue Ruin. I mean, a lot of the classics, Chinatown, The Apartment, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, the peril God, the apartment. Of just
fucking
talking
love that
about
movie. Goddamn.
The peril of talking about movies that you've selectively chosen is that a lot of these end up, there's more good movies on a year of double feature than just in a year of going to the movies.
Mm-hmm.
We have the benefit of 100 years of cinema before us and only 10 years of picking random movies out. And as much as it starts to feel like we've done everything, then we haven't done Shawshank and fucking Chinatown. And you're like, you know, you're missing some generally well-received stuff. All of those wound up out of what I generally consider my top 10.
Mm-hmm.
I will say there is probably a bias in some of these movies that is described by, I'll make this the last pair that I reference, but I'll just say actually generally, any of this out of control or tourism.
Sure.
Any of this, Kuso and Reality was the move, the pair we really mm-hmm. did to talk about that specific thing. But to what you were saying, the Human Centipede, even
Greasy Strangler, I mean,
even Soul Man to some degree, Greasy Strangler, of course, just anything that felt like off limits.
Yeah.
Even in bad taste. The ultimate one for me, actually, of all the movies this year was Thriller.
Yeah.
That was a movie that just feels like so wrong for today, such bad taste. And something about the thin-skinned nature of the general conversation about film, not as much in horror, a little there, but just film world in general and film on the internet in specific. After Tragedy and Ingrid Goes West, that started me leaving the internet. Mm-hmm. So I'm not around that stuff as much anymore, thanks in part to our show. But those conversations used to really get to me when activism and trying to make the real world would cross over into decrying and crushing terrible things done in the cinema world.
Mm-hmm.
And as someone who if you've listened to the show, you've listened to me literally grow up on these movies, on exploitation and on horror. You introduced me to like basically my first fucking horror movie live on air. And I now live in LA making these things. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's been an insane journey. But exploitation was the beginning light for me. It was the thing that said, you too can do this. And to see those movies, Thriller is such an ultimate example of an exploitation movie, just total bad taste, nothing, you know, just terrible things happening in it. That is my cocoon of safety. That is my safe space, is these movies of awful character.
Mm-hmm.
I like being around them. They make me feel like cinema is still a safe location to play with dangerous ideas,
mm-hmm.
wrong ideas, awful ideas. I don't think that we should be putting the taboos in the closet. I think we drag all the stuff you're not supposed to talk about out, and we shine a light on it, and we do that in cinema. And there's been a trend of trying to banish those things away and only, you know, I've been very diplomatic this whole fucking year about this thing, about trying to understand that 2018 real world America is terrible. Mm-hmm. People don't want to see terrible. They want to build a pleasant fantasy world.
Mm-hmm.
I've been very diplomatic on the show. I don't really feel that way. I go to the art house all the fucking time. I go to ones that are very far away that show the worst stuff. And I want to be with depraved humans cheering at depraved things. I just want nothing but French cinema. I want the stuff that's like hated at Cannes mm-hmm. and gets the most booed and is the most treacherous and terrible, because I want to know that people can still play with those ideas and that we haven't decided this is a new swear word that shall not be named.
Sure.
I want cinema to be the last place where we can take a terrible idea, put it under glass and stare at it. And that feels so good for my soul.
Yeah.
And so those are the pairs that I really clung to.
I got a couple movies. One kind of springs off what you were saying, and without sounding like a pompous douche, because I of course agree with you wholeheartedly about exploitation and the filth of cinema. But I think there's a part of me that transcended that. Mm-hmm. And I know where the gateway was. It was in erotic thrillers. I'm serious.
Okay, yeah, yeah. So, you've lost the part where you sounded pretentious for saying transcending.
So,
like, I have transcended above mere mortal and into erotic thriller.
Yeah, so I watched, you know, Basic Instinct, Fatal Attraction, Wild Things, Jade.
You are the greatest all human. These,
I mean, just so, and it was, you know, we did Basic Instinct on the show a while ago.
Yeah, yeah. It's when you achieved higher consciousness.
Yeah, I remember. No, yeah, seriously though. So I watched this, hey, weird. Bruno Hunziker just sent me a friend request on Facebook. We're friends now.
Oh, cool.
Live.
Paul Verhoeven sending me one.
So okay, cool. Perfect.
did you see his new movie this year, by the way?
Yeah. Fuck yeah. Movie's the shit.
Right.
And it proves my point. But anyway, I kind of watched these erotic thrillers and realized that they were exploitation in this interesting way that defies exploitation, which is that I don't believe that these movies came out with the intention of exploiting something. I think they accidentally exploited something and fell ass backwards into being an exploitation genre. And realizing that that can happen, that a movie can accidentally be exploitative, and like it's sort of like one-way glass in a train wreck, is why Simone is just one of my favorite things that we watched this year. Because I am not going to sit here and pretend I think Simone's a good movie, but I think that thematically it's ham-fisted tackling of certain ideas is so amazing to watch. It's probably like, if I had to randomly pick my favorite Al Pacino things, it's just below his Dunkin' Donuts commercial.
Yeah.
And so that's one of my favorite movies that I saw this year. I put it on the show half as a joke, but anything that starts half as a joke for me quickly becomes something I'm impassioned about. I mean, if we've learned nothing.
Sure.
And another movie that I just legitimately think is super fucking good and affected me in a real way, just to get back out of the hole of whatever shitty weirdness I just landed in. I think American Honey is just such a good movie.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's one of those movies where I walked into the movie as one person and I walked out with like an actual like outlook change.
Mm-hmm.
That's effective filmmaking.
Yeah. That's something that, you know, I started around Ghost in the Shell. Mm-hmm. That was a consciousness changing film. All those other films I mentioned were good, but that was really like a point where all of these movies I didn't expect to impact me as much as they did. Mm-hmm. And they did.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke about Ghost in the Shell. I spoke about Ingrid Goes West within the pair.
Ingrid for sure. Yeah.
One thing that I didn't talk about a lot on the show that we did with Ingrid, because it was so theme heavy, but it was one of my favorites of the last year as well, was Tragedy Girls.
Mm-hmm.
People who listen to the show and have gone through the Killapaloozas with us get this. And you and I will probably have some more conversation about this next year, but it is hard right now to do a slasher film.
Yeah.
For a number of reasons. And I think it's even harder to write a smart teen film, mm-hmm. even though so many people say that's what this or that movie is. To really do all of the movies that we kind of, you know, our way of trying to really point at that at the time was going, hey, you've seen this movie or this movie or this movie, and it swims with those as a way of getting it some kind of street cred, but also just saying, oh, this is intelligent. And we were, just the fact we were able to talk about a lot of those themes, I think should be enough to have kind of inherently said that. But that is really what I loved about Tragedy Girls, is how much it was doing with how little it had, and how many different other areas it was hitting these sweet slasher spots, these things that felt appreciative of 80s culture and of the things that have been in Killapaloozas without, you know, it was a movie for slasher fans without just being a slasher movie.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, maybe I think you could make a pretty easy case that it's not a slasher movie. Yet it really felt like if it were 10 minutes long, it would be the delicious buffer that cleanses your palate on a giant slasher marathon or some sort of 24-hour music box, you know, whatever. The other one that was very talky that I've already mentioned is Colossal. On the show, that was an inventive concept that is nothing like I've ever seen done, and talking about a thing that needs to be talked about more that has not been, just a domestic thing. I think to say too much what it is or isn't gives away too much in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to spoil it, but also it's a movie that wouldn't be genre at all, except that it plays with a giant kaiju mm-hmm. element.
Yeah.
Giant kaiju. Is there any other kind?
A giant.
But yes, yeah. A giant.
There's like sort of a kaiju element to the movie.
Yeah. So it just, it's another example similar to Tragedy Girls, where it just feels so like another person of the community, of the genre, who's having a conversation with us, but not doing the usual affairs that we get that are built into. There's nothing in Colossal, a kaiju movie, about nuclear warfare.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
Furthermore, a kaiju movie that takes place in Korea.
All right. So now that I'm at a comparable level almost with you, I had 5 more written down. I'll give you my other two.
Okay.
Again, that we've talked about substantially. One is don't breathe.
Uh-huh.
Don't breathe, because I thought at best I would get a new Feedy movie who I've discovered I loved, who did the Evil Dead remake.
Yep.
That would be kind of a tense, thrillery, you know, well done film. And it's so much more. It goes to this place that doesn't necessarily get headier, but does get more fucked up, darker and more perverse. And rather than being a movie that you know from the onset is pretty fucked up, it just throws that at you in a way that's kind of unsuspecting, where you just go, whoa, how did we get in this subterranean locale?
Yeah.
I love that about it. I love when a film knows how to kick it up another 8 degrees just out of fucking nowhere. And The Witch, of course.
Fuck yeah, The Witch, goddamn.
The Witch, for being a horror movie that, while sharing some common feelings and tones, is not about what any of the other movies are about. It's set in a time that isn't like anything else. It is a Ty West-esque unraveling yarn.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why all the yarn metaphors today, but it's been a kick with me lately. But yeah, it's just bringing you down a trail and you don't exactly know what you're going to get. And a movie that is so good that I can celebrate it in a way that is fun and exciting for me, even though nothing about the movie is. Now I only have 3. How about that?
Let me real quick machine gun off movies that I like that I don't want to talk too much about.
You could tell we never do this.
Human Centipede 3 is a movie I like, and I don't need to talk too much about it because you probably just finished listening to me gush all over it. And The Apartment is a movie that's so fucking good that I don't need to say it's good because everybody agrees with me already. So that said, there are 2 other movies, and then I'll save one more for the end for no reason, and it's an arbitrarily chosen film. It's not even my favorite. Glenn or Glenda is a movie that I've seen but hadn't seen in a while until doing it on the show. And to go back to my perverse love of the cinematic train wreck, Glenn or Glenda is a movie that you can't have made bad on purpose. It's
great conversation.
I know. It was so good. The show itself was amazing, but I just removing the conversation we had, that and Fear of a Black Hat, the film itself is so, it's one of those, I mean, like I just mentioned Human Centipede 3 and we talked last week, like you can't believe this is happening while you're watching it. But Glenn or Glenda is a movie that you can't describe what goes on the screen unless you're watching it.
Yeah.
And the thing that translates, and we talked about this on the show, is that it is a catastrophic nightmare of an attempt at making a movie with just the most palpable care and passion.
Yeah.
And those 2 things in tandem confuse my little brain to no end, because I come from a post-Clinton society where all kids, you know, if you really put your mind to something, you'll succeed. Well, it doesn't work. I've seen Glenn or Glenda. It doesn't work. You're wrong, society. Oh, also Society, great film, but that's not the one I want to talk about. The other one, and the one I would argue is the film that moved me the most this year,
but is not number one.
No,
it's a penultimate.
I mean, I didn't pick a number one, but it is penultimate.
Okay, well, just give me
a number last one I mention, but number second to last one I mention is Jim and Andy.
Hell yeah. That was the Jim Carrey,
Andy Kaufman, Netflix doc
film that we did with Brigsby Bear.
Yes.
Which was another, Brigsby Bear, yeah. But talk a bit about Jim and Andy.
Yeah, Jim and Andy is from an artistic standpoint and from the exploration that I've been harping on, which is how much does the artist matter in the art? How much does the auteur matter in the film? Who is the audience? How much is the audience in play when you're creating a piece of art? I mean, it's all varying versions of like, how do you really quantify art within a medium if you're not bouncing it off, you know, a theater? And that movie just reached me in a really interesting way because it created this narrative for me that I hadn't considered, which is that you know, and I don't mean in a meta sense, but, you know, you have a movie that takes place in a theater and then the audience reacts to the movie. But I mean, you can extrapolate so much further. I believe there's a point in the movie where he's like, I'm sitting in a space chair and my audience is the universe. And like, that's all craziness. But like, a big part of the film deals with the idea that there's an imaginary camera, there's an imaginary teapot in the sky. There's an imaginary camera in the sky that's looking down, and that is for whom you're performing. There's a Built to Spill lyric that's always been really important to me. God is whoever you're performing for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that looking at something like Jim and Andy, when you're asking who the audience is, and the audience is himself, he's doing it for his own validity. I think it is one of the most self-actualizing examples of creating art that I've ever seen. He's doing it solely to fulfill himself. He is unconcerned with anybody out. It's super Satanistic, but like, he's unconcerned with like anything outside of his own self. And I think it's super powerful and it's super scary and it's really challenging to me, and I hate it. And it made me question so much about the world that I live in and the life I'm leading.
Yeah, the phrase, I think the most used phrase award of the year goes to existential crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But that has been one that, you know, when a movie really shakes you to your core, mm-hmm. when it really stirs you in a way, what I thought was cool about Jim and Andy is that it was about, I mean, if you really look at the title, it's not only to say it's only a film about Jim Carrey, but it's only a film about Jim Carrey as he's playing Andy Kaufman.
Mm-hmm.
It's a movie about one guy's one role. And of course, it ends up being a movie about a lot of much larger things. But to manage to talk about those large things while really giving the appearance of talking about such a specific, if you haven't seen Man on the Moon, to think that this would still be a documentary full of things that would really impact you seems pretty crazy. It seems like that would be a challenge, let alone what they actually accomplished. Everybody knows to see Get Out. Everybody knows that I liked it on the show. It's dominated all the conversation. So obviously that's up there a lot for me. That was one of the films I saw. When I saw it, I knew like, oh, this is going to be it for me this year. One that we haven't talked about a lot because it was a while ago now was Hateful Eight.
Mm.
And Tarantino just continues to, when he's not around, he sort of lives now like a low-grade hum, just kind of in the, oh yeah, we know Tarantino exists. He does stuff sometimes. And Tarantino was one of the first filmmakers I got into.
He was one of the first filmmakers I wrongfully hated.
Yeah, sure. Oh, contrarian Michael. I mean, you know, Pulp Fiction was like the first film I saw that was more to me than just what I was seeing. And one of the first names I knew that inspired me to go down a path. And that doesn't mean much because it was that for everybody. I mean, that's why it affected, we've talked about this on movies before, but it, or on shows before, but it had such an impact that it was just fucking copied for years and years and years. Just every stupid pedestrian thing about it, just the most surface parts, whether it was just like the crime genre, telling a story out of chronological order for no reason. I mean, things that were smart in Pulp Fiction, but were done in a pedestrian way, or even just general things. Tarantino, I want to say, as I've grown to like more filmmakers, I get a little attached to like a Harmony Korine or a Lars von Trier. But then I see one of these fucking Tarantino movies again, and I want to think my palate has gotten so much more nuanced. And the Tarantino movie is still the fucking film event of the year.
Mm-hmm.
It's still like I see it and there's so much there. And it's like 20 good movies coming out at once in one fucking film.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot believe the power that these still have. For all the great things on Double Feature, one of the things that's lost is that every movie pretty much gets equal time. I mean, it doesn't, but it kind of does.
Mm-hmm.
Hateful Eight, especially considering how long it was, got exactly the same amount of time as Soul Man.
Right.
I mean, sure. That's just crazy.
Yeah.
You know, that's just nuts. Within a few minutes or whatever the fuck it was.
Two films with a big black dingus. Sorry, it's just a habit. You say two movies and I tell you the theme.
That was good. That was So I just wanted to briefly praise. This is one of the reasons you don't do a top 10 list, because when you start to get to the top, everybody fucking knows. But there's one that I saved. Do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll tell you what
film that I saved.
I'll tell you what movie is bar none the best film we've ever covered on Double Feature. It'd be my pleasure.
Here it comes.
No, honestly, this is a movie that I did save for the end of this conversation for me, because it goes against every other thing that I just tirated against with a post Get Out universe. It's a movie that I saw twice in the theater and liked better the second time. It's a movie that I didn't give a fuck about it coming out and went and saw it because I just see everything. And it's just, I mean, if Get Out sets the bar on the low budget end of horror, I think that the It remake proves that you can make effective, strong, fantastic horror cinema with 1,000 times the Get Out budget.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the reason that I feel like that's so much more important to me than a movie like Get Out, which I, again, love Get Out, but it's just not that important to me because it's created a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that It is coming out and going, look, like, it doesn't have to go this way. Horror can come out in all aspects of a budget. It doesn't have to be micro budget art house horror. There is an effective version of horror at every budget, for every audience, at every release level. And I don't want to say this because it seems like a backhanded thing, but I feel like it is so much fucking harder to make a movie like It as good as it is than a movie like Get Out or The Quiet Place, as good as those are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the nature of specializing with a micro budget, and I say micro budget, but it's $1 million more.
Yeah.
The benefit of specializing with a micro budget is you cut off everything that's tricky, risky, and you really nail the aspects you can afford. Nobody was on the set of It going, all right, well, how are we going to afford this special effect? How are we going to make this work on our budget? Instead, somebody was just figuratively printing money for this production.
I had an argument with a production company. I'll make this brief, but, you know, we're trying to get this funding for this movie I'm working on. And this guy said to me, you know, he's asking me to justify this tiny budget for a movie we're doing, that it's very low. It's less than Get Out money. It's very small.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, well, you know, I'm sure I'm sure you'd want $100 million for this movie if you could get it. And he could not understand when I told him, fuck no, I wouldn't want $100 million, mm-hmm. because that makes
everything possible
a much different and often terrible movie.
Yeah, yeah.
People might not understand this, but when you really look at the breakdown of these giant studio films, $100 million is the investment of a lot of people's, not only their money, but their career, their livelihood. So they have to get involved. And it really is, you know, if you want to look at this small or tourist horror, of course, something like Get Out can have an incredible vision at its price point. It's very hard for something like It to have incredible vision
and execution
at its price point.
Yeah.
Because it really is, so many people have such a vested interest. And if they don't all have the same, if they can't all get on the same path when there's 1 million paths available, it's very possible for them to go off in the weeds. I don't know what's harder. I have no fucking clue. But I would guess, my instinct says it is much harder to make an artistically satisfying $100 million film than it is to make an artistically satisfying $5 million film.
And that's why I love that movie. And that's why I've got it tattooed on my body forever.
All right, so the last one was one that I spaced on and you showed me. I don't know why this happened, but it affected me so much. I vowed to never let that happen again. And it changed my life because of that. And that is simply Raw.
Yeah.
The movie Raw is a movie that I probably knew I would have liked. It probably played 5 feet away from me in a theater all the time. And in my soul, I probably needed all of its French gory goodness, and I just didn't go. And you saw it first and you brought it on the show and you paired it up. And it was my awakening that I'm just missing everything. Everything about this movie said, I will like this movie. And I saw it and it over-delivered on everything I thought I was going to get. And like I said, it just felt good for my fucking soul.
Mm-hmm.
It was a new voice. It was visionary. It felt like there's a creator behind it who has something to say, a specific way of saying it. It's using genre tropes in a new inventive way. It's doing things that just feel like, oh, this is going to be a hard scene to watch. Or one of my favorite things that actually a number of these movies we talked about do, which is you're watching them and you're going, what's going to be scary about this? Where's the scare coming from? What am I supposed to be on guard for? I don't know what the fuck is going on in this movie. And that tone and style, so much about Raw, made me extremely happy and then mad at myself as an audience member for spending all of this time looking for where are these movies coming from and thinking that I'm on top of them and then just fucking spacing on one. And it ended up being my fourth or fifth time this year that we saw something on the show and I went, no, that's my new favorite one. I think it's pretty fucking cool that we have a show where that can happen. I'm going back now and just watching all the stuff I missed out on, either when I was on medication last year, which I've talked about on the show a couple of times, but just like fucked my memory and my brain. And there's shows I recorded I don't even remember. But also things when I had a Silicon Valley job, I just didn't watch movies. And I think increasingly over the years, you've shown me everything and I just miss so much stuff. And I also forgot how you watch movie after movie hoping to fall in love and you just see things that aren't, for whatever reason, aren't the one. And they could be terrible, they could be good, but they just aren't, and you're not going to buy them, you're not going to bring the movie home and spend time with it and watch it all the time. And on Double Feature, I get spoiled because you basically pre-screened the whole year for me and only brought me things that one, in some way, I think with a lot of these pairs, you thought I would like one of the movie and wanted to see. And two, you thought it would be good for a conversation. So the inherent bias is not only that you've liked it, that you thought it'd be pleasing in some way, and you thought that I would enjoy it. And to have like a personalized cue of all those movies has spoiled the fuck out of me. But it did create an environment where, I mean, time after time, I thought Get Out was good. I watched too early.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this is the best movie. And you're like, idiot, you're supposed to watch Don't Breathe. And I was like, this is the best movie. And then a couple of weeks later, we watch Ingrid. Or, you know, I had seen Tragedy Girls, but we watched Get Out. Just all of these movies, one after one. Colossal came out of fucking nowhere. So many good things this year. And maybe more good movies next year. What do you think?
We're going to roll the dice. We'll roll the dice on more movies next year.
Roll the dice. Yeah. Year 11, double feature, rolling the dice.
Snake Eyes, baby.
Coming up first, Snake Eyes and the remake of The Wicker Man. Like to get all my fake double features out on this year. So.
And by fake double feature, you mean the finale of, yeah, I get it.
Cool. Yeah.
Nailed it.
I'm starting already. Nailed it. I'm starting. I floated that Rings idea with Death Note.
Yeah.
I just thought I'd put that one out there. Yeah. And now we'll hit on Snake Eyes and Wicker Man.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how we feel in 50 shows. We'll see if the bees are still stinging our face.
All right. What are we doing the very next, I'm giving the executive producers a rest.
Give it a rest.
On this final episode, I want to thank everybody who contributed.
Fucking A.
patreon.com/doublefeature.
We are going to talk about that thing we always talk about at the beginning of the year, which is new contemporary horror movies by contemporary folks doing contemporary stuff in contemporary clothing.
That was not the case last year. We literally did The Witch. It was not contemporary clothing at all, but fine.
We're going to do a movie. I'm just going to out us. Ready?
Yeah.
That we haven't seen, called Victor Crowley. And then,
you know, that's going to get me in trouble.
I'm sorry. That's
your risk for outing us, very low. My risk, I didn't tell anyone I saw it, so that's good. But in fairness, they all knew it was coming out and didn't tell me. Fair. So fuck them.
Yeah, so fuck them. And then a movie that you and I have both seen, I think within 20 minutes of each other is how that worked.
Yes.
Because you went, oh my God, you have to do something. I'm going to tell you something and you just have to trust me and do it. Go see The Endless. And I went, dude, I'm literally sitting in the theater.
It was so funny. It was so good. We almost had an emergency show that week because I just felt the need to talk about The Endless so much. And I think there's a lot of themes with these movies, but we're just going to have to explore them on the episode itself.
Yeah, so we're going to do Victor Crowley, which is maybe a hatchet movie. It's a hatchet movie. And then we're going to do The Endless, which...
See their other movies. Yeah. You definitely haven't seen Resolution, so see that.
See their other movies. See Spring. Remember Spring?
Oh, fuck yeah, I remember that.
Cool. Well, that's like a lot of movies. So we pretended it's two movies, but it's actually like... 7 movies. So seriously though, you have to watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.